From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we begin the Begin with a tribute to Cole Porter, performed by jazz singer Barbara Lee. Also today, we talk with Lawrence Block, the author of the Matt Scudder Private Eye novels. Scudder used to be a hard-drinking private eye, but for the last few books, he's been sober. He's a loner who relies on the support of AA, but is rarely comfortable in a group. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Both Israeli officials and Shiite Muslim leaders vowed today to continue attacking each other after a week of violence in southern Lebanon. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Israeli planes and helicopter gunships today shelled three villages north of the area Israel calls its security zone in south Lebanon. In one of the attacks, the house of a Shiite Muslim businessman was destroyed, killing him, his wife, and two daughters. Reports from Lebanon say 15,000 Lebanese civilians have fled the area since the fighting began a week ago. The spiritual leader of Hezbollah, Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, today said Hezbollah would continue its jihad, or holy war, until Israel withdrew from South Lebanon. At the same time, a senior Israeli official said Israel will keep shelling in South Lebanon until Hezbollah stops its attacks against both Israel and the Israel-backed South Lebanon Army. Lebanon has also appealed to the UN Security Council against Israeli aggression. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Thailand's parliament met today to pass constitutional reforms after pro-democracy demonstrations that forced the country's prime minister from power. The reforms are designed to reduce the influence of Thailand's military, which seized power in February of last year. Hundreds of thousands of Thais protested the government last week, and nearly 50 of them were killed by government troops brought in to crush the demonstrations. Prime Minister Suchinda Kraprayun was forced to step down by widespread anger over the violence. He resigned after declaring an amnesty for himself and other senior military officers. A retired CIA officer will become the first Iran-Contra defendant to serve time in prison as he begins his sentence today. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Thomas Kleins was convicted in 1990 in connection with his role in arranging the purchase and delivery of rifles, explosives, and other arms to the Nicaraguan Contras. The convictions include failing to report profits from the arms shipments to the IRS. Kleins has appealed his case, but a federal court has refused to let him remain free while the appeal proceeds. So today, Kleins begins a 16-month term at a minimum security prison in Pennsylvania, although his lawyer says he expects Kleins to serve only about 8 months. So far in the Iran-Contra investigation, seven people have pleaded guilty to various crimes without serving any prison time. Former White House officials Oliver North and John Poindexter were both convicted of felonies, but the convictions were either dropped or reversed on appeal. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
High school students in Haiti protested today against a government order banning them from their classrooms. In recent weeks, some high school students have taken part in demonstrations against the military-backed government that ousted President Jean-Paul Aristide in September. Students from at least four high schools in Port-au-Prince defied the ban today and called for Aristide's return. This is NPR News. Serbia, which is accused of aggression against its neighbors in the former Yugoslav Federation, faced more internal dissension today. Ethnic Albanians, who make up a majority in the Serbian province of Kosovo, held an election yesterday and chose a pro-independence leader as president. Serbian officials declared the elections illegal. They fear that the vote could be a first step toward independence or even a union of Kosovo and neighboring Albania. Kosovo's Albanians held the election in private homes and outdoor polling places in defiance of the official ban. The preliminary results were released today. Colombian government troops clashed today with leftist rebels in the latest series of skirmishes in which dozens of people have been killed. Timothy Ross filed this report for the BBC.
The heaviest fighting is still in the northwestern region of Urabá, where the army has sent tanks in to support infantry, who've so far lost 37 killed, wounded, or missing in action. Attack jets and helicopter gunships have been strafing and bombing guerrilla positions, and their casualties are also believed high. In the south, 10 rebels are confirmed killed in Kauka province, and 6 more in other skirmishes, while a police unit has lost 5 men in an ambush closer to the capital. The panorama of violence has been worsened with a massacre by leftist militias in Colombia's second biggest city, Medellin. The death toll for the past 2 days is close to 50. Sabotage raids have also damaged oil pipelines and electricity lines, and there have been several smaller bombings in the cities. The rebels seem to be trying to capitalize on the public discontent with the government, caused especially by severe electricity rationing and a series of corruption scandals.
Timothy Ross reporting for the BBC from Bogota. Secretary of State James Baker arrived today in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia to express U.S. support for the government of Eduard Shevardnadze. Baker has a personal friendship with Shevardnadze that dates from the period when Shevardnadze served as the Soviet foreign minister. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're bringing you a concert we recorded last year to mark the 100th anniversary of Cole Porter's birth. It's really remarkable how many of Porter's songs have become pop and jazz standards. Just his songs starting with the letter I include I Concentrate on You, I Get a Kick Out of You, I Love Paris, In the Still of the Night, It's All Right with Me, It's Still Lovely, and I've Got You Under My Skin. What makes Porter even more remarkable is he wrote both lyrics and music. To perform some of his songs, we have Barbara Lee, a singer that John S. Wilson of the New York Times has described as one of the most knowledgeable interpreters and collectors of popular songs. She made her first record in the mid-50s and now records for Audiophile. Lee lives in New York, where she's been an important part of the cabaret scene. At the piano is Tony Tamburello, who has often accompanied Tony Bennett in performance and has been Frank Sinatra's rehearsal pianist. Here's Barbara Lee.
This song is from Jubilee, the show which gave us Begin the Begin and Just One of Those Things. And it concerned, I think, a native princess on a South Sea island dreaming of Hollywood and the States and romance and so on. Very lovely ballad. All my life I've been so secluded, love has eluded me. But from knowing secondhand what I'd do of it, I feel certain I could stand a closer view of it. Till today I've studied love discreetly, but now that I'm completely free, I must find some kind persona grata to give me data personally. Why shouldn't I take a chance when romance passes by? Is all that is really worth thinking of. It must be fun, lots of fun. To be sure, when day is done, that the hour is coming. Say it's good, and every star out in far Hollywood seems to give it a try. So why shouldn't I?
That's beautiful. Tell me, if you could, what makes Cole Porter singular to you, why you love his songs, what makes him different from other composers?
Gosh, you know, each great composer has his own particular way of writing. Cole Porter had a wonderful musical ear as well as wonderful musical training. And one thing that he did was vary the melody slightly in each eight bars. He'd go da-da in one and then da-da and then da-da, and he would do little variations, so it wasn't just the straight repetition. And they were very rich musically. The lyrics, of course, he was incomparably romantic. I really don't think any other lyric writer was as unabashedly passionate as Cole Porter. And at the same time, he had, of course, the marvelous cleverness, the great knowledge to write those laundry list songs of his and so on. And yet they weren't simply laundry lists. The way he shifted the interior rhymes around. People think rhymes are just rhymes. Not at all. Rhymes have everything to do with the rhythm of a song, the line length and so on. They just have everything to do with the variety of a song. It almost doesn't matter what the rhyme is so much as where it's placed. And of course, if he sets something up, which he often does, he'll set it up so that you're expecting a certain rhyme, and he'll give you something else. He just had everything going for him.
Tony, do you want to add something from your perspective as a musician about Cole Porter?
Well, his harmonies are so sophisticated, they're a joy to play. It's always something fresh coming up in a chord. I must tell you, Jerry, you know, this celebration with the anniversary, I'm working in town in a restaurant, and the Italian waiter comes up to me and says, "Tony, would you mind playing some Cold Water?" It took me a minute to figure it out.
Is that how well he knew Cole Porter's stuff?
No, but it was a request from some of the customers. They wanted to hear some Cole Porter, and he thought it was Cold Water.
Well, not everybody knows Cole Porter.
How about another song?
Oh, all right. This song is from a rather early Cole Porter show. I'm ashamed to say I can't remember the name of the show, but he wrote it, I believe, in the 20s while he was living in Paris and studying composition with Nadia Boulanger. And the verse particularly just shows the astonishing things that he was able to do, whether because of the influence of this legendary composer trainer or not, I don't know. But of course, it has that wonderful Cole Porter naughtiness. Since first you crossed my horizon with your load of love charms, I spend my whole time devising means to stay in your arms. There must be some tricky treatment that would cool my brain, for to me it's so plain, and you'll admit the fact that I'm practically sane. You're a bad influence on me. Sorry, but you're a bad influence, I must say. For I get in such a dither when you use your famous come hither, that all thought of hame and mither seems to wither away. The thing your eyes do to me is such folly that I feel sure your middle name must be Svengali. You throw me right off of my stride. Still, I beg of you, stay by my side and be a bad influence on me. Thank you. want to start shooting, 'cause I'm sure you used to say black mass with Rasputin. I wish you'd cease singeing my wings, but before you do, take off your things and be a bad influence on me.
That was great. It's a wonderful lyric. It must be really nice to sing songs that you can sing with conviction, because the lyric's so well written, you don't have to be embarrassed by any lines.
Yes, yes, yes. Sometimes you get a request for a song that isn't well written, and then it's really a test. It's really a challenge to think, what am I going to do? This is such a nice person. I want to do this song for this person. What can I do to it to make this lyric come alive? And what can I do to get over these embarrassing places? Often you find you just have to go counter to the intent of a song. Sometimes it'll be so ridiculously romantic that you have to take it very casually, or sometimes it's a kind of casual, hard-boiled song that you have to bring romance to. It's just...
Barbara Lee, I want to find out a little bit about you.
Oh, all right.
Now, you started recording back in 1955.
Yes, yes.
What were you like then? How was your voice different? What were you singing?
My voice was very much the same, except that for the last 5 years or so, I've been solvent, so I've been able to take voice lessons.
You're taking voice lessons now?
Now. I've just started, and it's wonderful, and it hasn't changed my voice at all, except... It's easier. Everything flows more easily now. It's opened up the range. I've got a little more range on top and a little more on the bottom. Basically, I've had the same range since I was a tiny child. So, you know, people would say, you're Barbara Leacock. I haven't seen you since you were 4 years old. I'd know you anywhere by your voice.
Barbara Leacock, huh?
That was me.
That was your real name?
Yes, yes, from Detroit.
And you changed it to Barbara Lee to perform?
Yes.
Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more, and we'll hear some more songs by Cole Porter. And singing is Barbara Lee. At the piano is Tony Tamburello. And we're after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Featuring a concert of Cole Porter songs performed by Barbara Lee. When we asked you to do the concert, we asked you to do some songs that we'd all know and a couple of songs that would be discoveries for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the song you're about to do is something that's going to be a discovery for us.
Yes, yes, I hope so. I've never heard anyone else do it. I just found a piece of sheet music in Lincoln Center Library. It was sung by the mother of the debutante in... I think the New Yorkers, not the New Yorkers. Oh, goodness, I'm going to goof everything. Paris? 50 Million Frenchmen. That's it. He wrote so many Paris shows and so many New York shows, I get them mixed up. 50 Million Frenchmen. What is that, my note?
You like that one?
Give me a card, don't give me a note. My mother and father once went to a lot of bother to make me the happiest of girls. To further my station, they gave me an education, not to mention a string of pearls. But in spite of my backing, I still feel there's something lacking, and that fate has rather let me down. For instead of being famous, I'm an unknown ignoramus from a small Middle Western town. Why couldn't I have have been Salome or Mary Pickford or Joan of Arc. If I were Eleanor Glynn or even Anne Boleyn, the future wouldn't look half so dark. Why couldn't I be Whistler's mother or any other woman of note? Why did the gods decree that I should only be the Queen of Terra?
That's great. So you found that on sheet music.
Yes.
And you've never heard it performed.
No. Mm-mm.
You think it's recorded anywhere?
I don't know. Huh. I don't know. I know it's from the 20s. I can just see Mary Boland or somebody kind of wandering out onto a stage disconsolately. For some reason, I see her with a suitcase in her hand.
So this is the kind of thing you do a lot, just go searching for sheet music of obscure songs.
Oh, yes. Yes, it's my favorite pastime.
And we'll contrast that with a very well-known song that you're about to sing for us.
When they begin the begin, it brings back the sound of music so tender. It brings back a night of tropical splendor. It brings back a memory evergreen. I'm with you once more under the stars, and down by the shore an orchestra's playing, and even the palms seem to be swaying. When they begin the begin, to live it again is past all endeavor, except when that tune clutches my heart, and there we are, swearing to love forever and promising never, never to part. What moments divine, what rapture serene, till clouds came along to disperse the joys we had tasted. And now when I hear people curse the chance that was wasted, I know but too well what they mean. So don't let them begin the begin. Let the love that was once a fire remain an ember. Let it sleep like the dead desire I only remember. When they begin the begin. Oh yes, let them begin the begin. Make them play till the stars that were there before return above you, till you whisper to me once more, darling, I love you. And we suddenly know what heaven we're in when they begin the beginning.
That's beautiful. I think that's the saddest and most felt version of that I've ever heard. It's usually much more kind of up-tempo and
yes.
danceable. And
yeah.
Tell me about thinking through the song and deciding it to do it that way.
Well, all I can tell you is that you have to know the story before you can tell the story. People are so interested in selling their sadness or selling their joy or whatever it is, but they don't ever bother to feel that. And I just, you know, I was an actress for many years, and I know what that song's about from my life. If I didn't know what it was about from my life, I'd know what it was about from my imagination. And I tell the story. That's all. And I love it. I love that. I think it's possibly the greatest song ever written. I know it's never been done this way. And I know if they try, they won't be able. So this song is mine. New York, New York is Liza Minnelli's. This one is mine.
It's really been a pleasure to hear you sing.
Thank you.
Barbara Lee, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me.
Our concert with Barbara Lee was recorded 1 year ago. She was accompanied by pianist Tony Tamborello. Barbara Lee's latest records are Sweet and Slow, You're the Cats, and an album of songs from the Duke Ellington musical Pousse Café. They're all on the Audiophile label. She'll perform in Philadelphia June 17th at the Free Library, and in New York she performs at Jay's on June 13th and at Judy's Cabaret on June 16th and 18th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Matt Scudder is a tough private eye and a recovering alcoholic, trying to deal with both killers and his drinking problem. Scudder is the creation of crime novelist Lawrence Block. Coming up, we talk with the author of 8 Million Ways to Die and A Dance at the Slaughterhouse. That and more coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Thailand, parliament members have moved quickly to approve democratic amendments to that nation's constitution. This action comes in the wake of violent pro-democracy demonstrations, which led to the resignation over the weekend of Thailand's prime minister. NPR's Deborah Wong reports from Bangkok.
It took just hours for a joint session of parliament to give preliminary approval to a series of constitutional amendments, chief among them, a clause which would require all future prime ministers to be elected members of parliament. Pro-democracy groups had insisted on the clause after General Suchinda Kraprayun was appointed prime minister this past April. Suchinda was an unelected army chief who led last year's military coup d'etat. Suchinda was forced to resign this weekend after ordering a military crackdown on anti-government demonstrations. Scores of civilians were killed. Opposition parties are calling for an investigation into the killings, and they're trying to strike down an amnesty decree signed by Suchinda so that the military commanders who ordered the crackdown can face trial. I'm Deborah Wong in Bangkok.
According to officials of the European Community, efforts are underway to find a way to break a deadlock in world trade talks after agreement on U.S. calls to lower farm subsidies. Secretary of State James Baker will meet next week with EC officials. One of the major roadblocks to agreement has been U.S. opposition to high subsidies paid to EC farmers. Officials have said a cut in subsidies should lead to continued talks on general agreement on tariffs and trade. In Serbia, the government has bitterly criticized the growing international campaign to isolate the Belgrade government for its military actions in Bosnia. Pierre Vickery reports there appears to be much concern over Russia's decision to follow the U.S. and the European Community in advocating tough economic and political sanctions.
With more and more countries recalling their ambassadors from the Serbian capital Belgrade and daily announcements of fresh international sanctions, the Serbian authorities have begun questioning the fairness of the campaign. The Republic's Vice President, Nikolaj Sinovic, said a threatened oil embargo would be illogical, as the last Yugoslav troops were in the process of withdrawing from Bosnia. The protest follows a visit to Slovenia and Croatia by the Russian Foreign Minister, Andrei Kozyrev, a move emphasizing Russia's determination to be seen playing an even-handed role in the resolution of the crisis in former Yugoslavia. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
And the International Red Cross says it will not resume operations in Bosnia until it is certain that warring factions will honor a new agreement promising safety for Red Cross workers. This is NPR News. In Germany, some 2,000 workers in the clothing industry have taken part in warning strikes for higher pay. Employees want a pay increase of 9.5%, as do other German employees. Last week, metal workers and print workers ended a series of warning strikes after reaching pay increases of between 5.4 and 5.8%. German Chancellor Kohl's government has called for pay increases of below 5% to keep inflation down and cut deficits caused by the high cost of German unification. In Guadalajara, Mexico, thousands of people remain homeless after last month's fatal explosion. More than 150 people are still missing, and now there has been an outbreak of cholera. Bibi Kraus reports.
Two cases of cholera have been confirmed in the neighborhood devastated by last month's explosions. The disease has been detected in sewage that now flows in open trenches where sewer pipes exploded. The two victims were hospitalized, and residents of the area have been warned to take precautions against contracting the disease. Meanwhile, victims of the disaster complain that emergency assistance has barely trickled into the area, despite government promises of quick relief. During a recent visit to the area, Mexican President Carlos Salinas was forced to curtail some activities because of demonstrations by angry victims. Officials say they hope more relief payments will be made this week. For National Public Radio, this is B.B. Krause in Mexico City.
Syria says it is committed to the Middle Eastern peace process, but will respond if there is war imposed by Israel. Yesterday, Israeli officials said a small war with Syria cannot be ruled out if Syria fails to prevent pro-Iranian factions in South Lebanon from attacking. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Usually when I go on vacation, I read books by dead authors, so I won't be distracted by thoughts of what I would ask them in an interview. But on a recent vacation, I read a book by the very much alive Lawrence Block, a detective writer who had come highly recommended. I liked the novel so much that in spite of being on vacation, I all too predictably started planning an interview. Well, we recorded the interview earlier this spring. Block has written close to 10 novels about Matt Scudder, a private eye whose turf is Manhattan. Scudder is a former cop who quit the force after he accidentally shot and killed a teenager. He's left his wife, two kids, and home in the suburbs and now lives alone in a small, dingy hotel room. The latest Scudder novel was published last year. The one I read on vacation, 8 Million Ways to Die, came out in 1982. This moody novel was a turning point for Scudder. After years of hard drinking, he tries staying sober and joins AA. It's not easy for this cynical loner to feel at home in a support group. Here's a reading.
I got to the meeting a couple of minutes early. Half a dozen people said hello to me by name. I got some coffee and sat down. The speaker told an abbreviated drinking story and spent most of the time telling of all the things that had happened to him since he got sober 4 years ago. His marriage had broken up, his youngest son had been killed by a hit-and-run driver, he'd gone through a period of extended unemployment and several bad bouts of clinical depression. I wanted to leave at the break. Instead, I got a cup of coffee and took a couple of Fig Newtons. I ate the cookies. It was like chewing straw, but I chewed them and washed them down. During the discussion, one woman got into a long riff about her relationship. She was a pain in the ass. She said the same thing every night. I tuned out. I thought, my name is Matt, and I'm an alcoholic. A woman I know got killed last night. She hired me to keep her from getting killed, and I wound up assuring her that she was safe and she believed me. And her killer conned me, and I believed him, and she's dead now, and there's nothing I can do about it. And it eats at me, and I don't know what to do about that, and there's a bar on every corner and a liquor store on every block, and drinking won't bring her back to life, but neither will staying sober. And why the hell do I have to go through this? Why? I thought, my name is Matt, and I'm an alcoholic, and we sit around in these goddamned rooms and say the same damn things all the time, and meanwhile out there all the animals are killing each other. We say don't drink and go to meetings, and we say the important thing is you're sober, and we say easy does it, and we say one day at a time, and while we natter on like brainwashed zombies, the world is coming to an end. I thought, my name is Matt, and I'm an alcoholic, and I need help. When they got to me, I said, my name is Matt. Thanks for your qualification. I enjoyed it. I think I'll just listen tonight.
Lawrence Block, thanks for reading that passage from 8 Million Ways to Die. You know, having your main character, Matthew Scudder, having given up alcohol creates this intense mood of constant craving for what he can't have. And in 8 Million Ways to Die, life is kind of drained of color and meaning during these periods when he's really craving alcohol. I guess what got you thinking about how you could use that in the novel?
Well, the Matthew Scudder series of books evolved gradually. 8 Million Ways to Die was the fifth book in the series. And in the first three books, he's a hard drinker who doesn't really pay much mind to the effects or implications of his drinking. And when I started writing the books, I fully intended that he would stay like that forever. Most series detectives certainly are static characters. They don't change much. That's always been the case. And I found, as the series progressed, the fourth book was called A Stab in the Dark, and in that one he's beginning to see that there's something pathological about his drinking but doesn't really want to look at it. And in 8 Million Ways to Die, that was a pivotal book in which his struggles with his alcoholism and his being forced to come to terms with that are really as much a part of the book as is the solution of a crime.
I find it interesting, you know, that you've taken this character who loves hanging out at bars, and a lot of his sources are at bars, and he even goes to bars after joining AA because that's kind of where he lives. I wonder, well, I should ask you first if you had a problem with alcohol and if you had to give it up and if you're writing out of a first-person knowledge about some of these things.
Well, I don't like to talk about that too much, but I will say that I used to drink rather the way Scudder did, and I don't drink anymore.
Do you still hang out in bars? I mean, is there something about bars that you like very much in spite of the fact that you can partake of the alcohol?
No, not particularly. My own experience is that bar conversation that may have seemed fascinating and stimulating years ago seemed to require a fairly high blood level of alcohol in order to be all that absorbing.
So why does your character keep going back?
Well, he there's only really one bar that he hangs out at a lot, and that's because of a particular relationship he has with a fellow he met. Yeah, I should probably say that I thought the books were going to end with 8 Million Ways to Die. That seemed to be a catharsis in the character's life, and I thought, gee, there's no place to go after this. His detra has lost its raison. You know, he's still a detective, but you know, let him go get a life on his own time. But it turned out that I liked the character a lot. I liked seeing the world through those particular eyes and all, and I did write further books about it. There have now been, I think the 10th is going to be coming out in September, called A Walk Among the Tombstones.
The neighborhood that is your detective's territory is Manhattan, the upper 50s, the far west side, 9th Avenue, 10th Avenue.
Right.
How did that become your neighborhood as a writer?
Well, I was living there when I first started writing about Scudder. In fact, I was living on the same block, though not in a hotel. I had an apartment on that block and hung out at a lot of the places that he hung out at in the early books, most of which, I might add, are gone now. The neighborhood has changed, and there's been the usual kind of attrition with commercial establishments, so that it's hard to find a lot of Scudder's old haunts.
I used to house at an apartment that was right next door to Polly's Cage, which is a bar,
yes,
that Scudder used to hang out at, and it's now a kind of cafe restaurant.
Right. It looks very yuppie now. Wasn't it a tacky place? It was.
Oh,
it was
sure
marvelous.
Was.
Marvelous.
So you watch your old neighborhood get gentrified. Do you still live there?
No, I live down in the Village.
Uh-huh.
I have for a few years now.
You actually moved out of New York for a couple of years.
Yes, yes.
Why did you leave?
It's hard to remember. It was a vastly failed experiment. We moved down to the Gulf Coast of Florida for a stretch, and we did not transplant well.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lawrence Block, and he writes the series of detective novels featuring Matthew Scudder, and his latest is called A Dance at the Slaughterhouse. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Writer Lawrence Block is my guest. Let me get back to 8 Million Ways to Die.
Sure.
Again for a second. You know, the main character keeps reading the New York Daily News, and every day there's another really gruesome murder that's taken place that's in the headlines. And that's where the title 8 Million Ways to Die comes
right.
from. Because for each person in New York, there's another way of possibly...
Mm-hmm.
being murdered or killed. What's your reaction when you read that stuff in the paper?
Well, it was interesting, and that particular book, when I was writing that, I was living up in Washington Heights at that particular time, and I would do my day's work, and then I would leave the house generally late afternoon, pick up a copy of the news, and get on the subway and ride downtown. And the horrible stories that Scudder dutifully reports each time were the ones that I'd read the night before and that I then would write about. You know, the city never failed to provide heinous atrocities for me to report in the next day's writing. It was quite bizarre.
Yeah, I want to get back to your travels. You've lived in New York, moved to Florida for 2 years. After Florida, I think you just picked up stakes, and you and your wife drove around the country for 2 years.
We spent 2 years living without a fixed address, yes.
And just to give it a sense of structure, I think, you decided to visit every town named Buffalo that you could find in the country. And
yes, we did. I had grown up in Buffalo, New York, and I had discovered in the course of some research for another book that there were more towns named Buffalo than I had realized, that there were indeed about 20 of them. And I said to my wife, we should go to some of these. And my wife, who is at least as deranged as I am, drew herself up very straight and said, I think we should go to all of them. So we began attempting to do that and discovered similarly to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, that simply the act of looking for buffaloes caused more to appear. We have now, at this count, we've been to 63 and know of another 20. So the original 20 has grown to somewhere in the 80s. And I have a feeling that this will just go on forever. It's like looking for subatomic particles.
Did this turn out to be a pointless exercise or an interesting one?
A friend of mine, a singer named Tom Bishop, heard the story, and I said, I think it's really pretty pointless. And he said, I don't know, it makes as much sense as golf. So it gave a structure to things. It gave us a reason to turn left rather than right when we got to an intersection, and it facilitated a wonderful rambling couple of years. And we're by no means done. We intend to keep on as long as there's another buffalo.
Do you feel that the detective genre has changed in the years that you've been writing in it?
Yes, I do think so. I think one big change is that the books now tend to be a lot more about the detectives than they used to.
As opposed to about the murder and the plot and the whodunit aspect.
Right. Right. Classic hard-boiled works, for example, we learn very little about Philip Marlowe or Lou Archer or the Continental Op. We know very little about them, and we don't learn more and more as we read additional books, nor do they change. They don't really have a life. This isn't much the case with most of what's being written now. And if one were taking a dim view of this, you could call it the soap operaization of the category, in that readers want to know what happens in the life of the character. And writers seem to be inclined to write that. Certainly, the Scudder novels are about Scudder, just as they're about the solution of a crime.
I think in a lot of ways the crime genre has become the genre that really tries to be about character, a sense of place, and a sense of contemporary life, too, because the detective is always very observant and is observing how people are living today.
I think so. It's somehow had this mantle placed at its disposal because I think so much of contemporary mainstream fiction has become about less and less. Not merely minimalist work, but a lot of books are about themselves or are about writing or are about language rather than being about what books traditionally were about, which was their story and their characters.
A lot of despair in a lot of crime fiction, in part because the detective is often lonely and is exposed to the most brutal aspects of society. And I'd say probably not so much in the more recent stuff, but, you know, Scudder has dealt with his share of despair. There must be something about that kind of mood that you personally respond to.
Oh, sure. I don't always walk along humming, you know, but I think this is a hard world, and most people have a great deal of grief in their lives, you know, and I don't feel it's my mission solely to reflect that in my work, and a lot of my work is quite lighthearted. Certainly there's a series of books I did about a burglar named Bernie Rodenbaugh, which they're also set in New York, and it's a different New York from the one that that Scudder lives in. The streets are the same, but the feel is different.
Does it ever feel odd to you that the character you've created is always having these life-endangering adventures while you're almost always sitting home and typing?
Well, no, I haven't thought about that much. I suppose in certain respects, Scudder's life is more interesting and dramatic than mine, but otherwise he'd be sitting around writing about me.
Lawrence Block's latest novel is A Dance at the Slaughterhouse. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel of All Things Considered. Coming up later on today's program, we'll hear about how the recent riots in Los Angeles are affecting campaigning for one of California's two Senate seats that are being contested this year. Also, the government's new policy on Haiti, trying to prevent refugees from landing. What happens next to Thailand's former Prime Minister Suchinda? Linda Gradstein also reports on sealing off the Gaza Strip today following a violent weekend in Gaza and in Israel. And we'll hear about both the traditional Memorial Day observance in Grafton, West Virginia, and the city with no Memorial Day parade today for the first time in memory, New York City. That and also a man who has set up a museum for mustard on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Ethiopian singer Esther Awiki has a new album. Our world music commentator Milo Miles reviewed her debut album and finds her second effort dramatically improved.
Esther Awiki's first album was a sore disappointment, especially since contemporary pop from Ethiopia is so rarely released in this country. Awiki came across as a heartfelt fan of soul and hip-hop without much of a clue how to put her passion across. The horn charts were clumsy and thick, and she squealed a lot to show excitement. I didn't think she had much in the way of prospects. Her new album, Kabu, proves me dead wrong. It's a complete turnaround and an enduring delight. Awike still squeals, but on tunes like Yedi Ghosh, which means my guy, she throws vivid trills and gasps all over until she sounds like an exotic scat singer. Her horn accompaniment is lighter and airier, and Faya Virgil, who plays a slew of instruments, is a peppy knockout with his solos and comps. Awike doesn't stick with simple lust and heartbreak on Kabu. She delivers an irresistibly cheerful song about Ethiopian New Year celebrations, and she hooks a couple other tunes to lists of towns and districts familiar to her audience. This is an ancient guaranteed crowd pleaser and the same bit used in dozens of blues songs and R&B ravers, notably by James Brown in Night Train. Awike's Kabu even features one track that strongly echoes the spacey, smoky tone of her fellow Ethiopian star, Mahmoud Ahmed. There is one sure sign that Astor Awike is playing her own music now instead of the crossover game. Kabu is altogether more measured and easygoing than her first record. Energetic foreign performers sometimes think that successful American pop albums have to be frantic as Manhattan at rush hour. Americans live fast, listen faster, enjoy constant bustle in the top 40. Well, some singers the manic style fits and most it doesn't. Awike is clearly better off taking her time. While I hope the lyrics to her song, Loneliness, are less banal and cliched in Ethiopian than they are in English translation, it's still a number that's rare in world music. A ballad of lost love that can give you a chill even if you don't know the words. I bet it's the quavering traditional melody. On the other hand, maybe it's just Astor Awike getting in touch with her understated soul.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. Astor Awike's new album, Kabu, is on the Columbia label. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Thad Kirk, and Bob Alls. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, boiling hallucinations, grotesque demons, and a spirit child. We'll talk with Nigerian-born writer Ben Okri, who won the Booker Prize for his novel The Famished Road. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.